Hey, everybody, welcome to another episode of What's It Like, where I interview folks from all over the place about all kinds of different experiences and get a sense of what it might be like to live a day in their lives. And my typical disclaimer, as always, this is one person's story. This is not everybody's. Somebody else may have gone through something similar and have a very different experience, and that's okay. We're just getting a window into what this might be like for somebody. So I'd like to go ahead and welcome our guest for today. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Thanks for having me, Hannah. I'm excited to be here.
Me too. All right. So go ahead and tell us in a sentence or two, what is the experience that you're going to be sharing with our listeners today?
Well, at age 46, I survived a stroke.
Whew. All right. So let's start. I think it makes most sense, I guess, to start with the day of. So tell me about that day. What happened? When did you realize something was wrong? What did you do? Tell me how that went down.
Sure. So it was June 3rd, 2017. It was a Saturday. And I basically woke up at about 7:15 in the morning. So you already know something is wrong if I'm getting up at 7 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday. I woke up and my left arm felt a little weird. I figured I just slept on it wrong because I'm in my 40s and that's a thing that happens now. I got up to go use the bathroom and my left arm just didn't come back. It just didn't start waking up the way it normally does when you sleep wrong on a limb or a hand or something. And then I started to have trouble standing as my left leg began to go offline as well. And it was just sort of this continuing failure of things on the left side of my body. I caught a look at myself in the mirror and the left side of my face was starting to look a little weird too. At that point, I kind of flashed back to a story I had seen on online about a reporter some years back who had an apparent stroke on the air. And I was like, oh, is that what's happening here? And so I started just sort of checking to see, can I still speak sensibly? And I could, but I started to sound a little off. So I went ahead, woke up my girlfriend and told her, I think I need an ambulance. And she recognized that I was probably having a stroke and called 911. The paramedics got there very quickly. They began doing some of their tests, testing blood pressure. And at this point, I was sitting on the floor of the bedroom because, well, I couldn't stand.
Yeah.
Couldn't really get up. They were like, yep, that's probably what's happening. They took me down, managed to get me onto a stretcher and into an elevator that is way too small for a stretcher. Cool. And with a door that just keeps insisting on trying to close even when something's in the middle of the doorway. started loading me into the ambulance and asked me which hospital I wanted to go to, because in my neighborhood in Seattle, for those who know Seattle, I was living in the First Hill neighborhood at the time, and there are just multiple hospitals within a short walking distance. And I said Swedish, mainly because I remembered thinking my girlfriend had gone there for surgery some years before and hadn't died, so that seemed like the right call to make. At the same time, I was wondering that, okay, these people are now asking the person whose brain is currently dying to make a major life decision. And I'm not certain that was the best thing.
Yeah.
But they sped me off to the hospital. We paused briefly as soon as they took me in the doors of the ER to slap an ID bracelet on my wrist and stick in a couple of IVs. And then it was off to the CAT scan. Spent the rest of the day in the emergency room, went down for MRIs, had ultrasound of my heart and a whole bunch of other tests, and basically lived in that building for the next month.
Wow. So I'm curious, as this was happening, especially at the beginning this was in process, this was affecting you physically. Was it affecting you cognitively in any way? Were you like alert and aware the entire time? Was there anything that went out there?
I was pretty much alert and aware the entire time, just because the nature of where my stroke was. It happened on the right side of my brain. It actually sort of broke my basal ganglia, which is basically this part of the brain that is sort of this network hub of data for how the brain drives the body and other functions. So in that respect, it did not necessarily affect me cognitively, but anytime you impact the right side of the brain, your left side, the more logic and rational part, can become a little more dominant, and vice versa if you have a stroke on the other side. So I was sort of in sort of very automatic problem solving mode. It's like, okay, what do I do? What do I have to do next? How do I get better? And just trying to go through that. And what's interesting too, is that over the course of the day, I continued to lose that function on the left side of my body. It finally bottomed out around 3 p.m. that day. That's the thing about a stroke, is it's not just something that just happens in an instant and it's done. The damage progresses as it goes through. In terms of the way my mind was reacting, I did end up dealing with emotional lability, or also called pseudobulbar affect. And what that is that's when you sort of start laughing or crying at either inappropriate times or at the slightest provocation. So whether that is just exerting yourself physically or seeing a commercial on TV or whatever, you know, you can just start crying. And what's interesting about that is that I would start crying but not feel sad or not feel the emotion typically connected with crying. It was just sort of a physical manifestation of that as the brain is going through that trauma. Huh. I did find myself getting unreasonably angry at random things, not a whole lot of it, but I remember every day I was in the hospital, we had to fill out our menu form for what we wanted to eat the next day. And that task just made me incredibly angry. And I have no idea to this day why, and generally I didn't react that way with other stuff, but it was just sort of that little thing. And, you know, brains are weird.
Yeah. Yeah. And so when it bottomed out, when it stopped, when those symptoms stopped progressing, is that because there was some kind of medical intervention that stopped it, or did it just like run its course and it was done?
It kind of ran its course.
Okay.
Basically, when a stroke happens, if you get to the emergency room at the appropriate hospital fast enough, there are a couple of medical interventions that they can do in the first 3 to 4 hours that can end a clot, or they have a few more hours. They can go in and physically drag a clot out of your brain by going in through an incision in the groin, which is pretty amazing stuff.
Gosh, yeah.
But in my case, I was a wake-up stroke because I woke up with symptoms. My last known good time was at about 1 a.m. The night before. So I was out of the window for the available interventions in the summer of 2017. And that's why it's so important, where if you observe anyone having symptoms or you feel you're having them, to call an ambulance as soon as possible, because the earlier you can get there, the fewer long-term disabilities you will have.
Yeah.
But yeah, mine had kind of run its course. The clot had probably already dissipated by then. But I mean, part of the reason why it progresses is there's the initial shock, but what's actually causing the damage is that the brain cells are starving and suffocating when they don't get that circulation. And then some of them are able to hang on and sort of linger as they starve to death. And that's sort of what continues to happen.
Yeah. Okay. So you were in the hospital and then you were there for a long time. Were they running tests during this? Were they keeping you under observation in case it happened again? What was the primary, primary procedure for keeping you in the hospital for that length of time?
It was primarily, most of the time was around rehab. Okay. So that first day was all about tests and let's see if we can understand what's happening. Let's first of all, let's confirm that this is a stroke. Let's figure out what type of stroke it is. Is it a clot or an ischemic stroke, or is it a bleed, a hemorrhagic stroke? In my case, they quickly determined that it was a clot, which is what about 80 to 85% of strokes are. So there was no bleeding to go in and stop. In fact, what you needed to do was sort of get that blood circulating. So they started doing that. That was what the CT and the MRI scans were for. They did an ultrasound of my heart to look for a hole in the heart, which is one thing that can cause a stroke. And about 25 to 33% of the population has that hole in the heart. So it was that. It was a lot of, let's just stabilize. Let's make sure this isn't going to happen again in the short term. And so that's sort of what they were doing that first day. So I spent the first 4 or 5 hours in the emergency room in a little private room in the ER. And then they moved me up to the neuro ICU floor, where, again, they were just sort of monitoring me for the first day, making sure, you know, I wasn't allowed to, you know, elevate my head. They wanted to make sure that there was plenty of circulation going back into my brain. And then just sort of monitor that. And by day two, then they're like, okay, let's sort of start figuring out if you're well enough for rehab. So that involved just sort of trying to understand what are my current conditions? Has my blood pressure stabilized? Has my health stabilized? Do I have the strength to sit up? Can I be awake for more than a few hours? Am I able to swallow food and testing on all of that and sort of getting those various systems back up online? Are you able to clear your bladder appropriately? Are you able to clear your bowels appropriately and get through all of this just to make sure there's nothing immediate that we need to address? So after about 3.5 days there, they moved me up to the 6th floor of the hospital, which was the inpatient rehab facility. So that's where I spent the bulk of the time, with 3 hours of rehabilitation every day, still plenty of medical intervention there, daily visits from the doctors, working with the nurses and the physical therapists and the occupational therapists. And that's, you know, they had me assessed by the speech therapists, but once they determined I didn't have any significant cognitive issues and I was able to eat and swallow, then it was all about PT and OT, where the physical therapists, their job was to teach me how to walk again at age 46. And, you know, that's a lot of work, because the last time I learned how to walk, I was one and the ground was a lot closer. And the OT, and so they're all about getting that physical ability in the legs back and helping you learn to balance and to walk. The occupational therapists, they were more focused on helping me either learn to use my arm, try to use my arm again, try to wake up the arm and the hand, and if not, how to accomplish ADLs, or activities of daily living. Making sure that I could, helping me, you know, sort of learn to bathe again, making sure I could brush my teeth, and how I can operate safely and getting around safely and manage a wheelchair safely, and introduce concepts like, remember, since my left arm was off, you have to occasionally go ahead and check to make sure it's where you think it is. Because sometimes I would just sort of let it droop and I would look down and find it between the frame of the wheelchair and the wheel of the wheelchair, which is a very bad place for it to be. And then having to deal with, now let's make sure your arm doesn't pull itself out of its out of the shoulder, since the shoulder is the worst designed joint in the human body. And just sort of trying to live with those types of things and hit that balance between learn to live with the disabilities safely and not come to rely on alternatives to using the limb.
Wow. Okay. So between the, I guess, my next question is how successful was that? Either when did you start seeing something that, did you regain any of this? And if so, to what extent?
I did start to have things start to wake up within the week a little bit. So I was, when they started me in PT and started me with walking, a lot of it was just, helping me sit up. And then it took two people to get me out of the bed and into the wheelchair. Mm-hmm. Over the course of the coming weeks, it went down to one. And then just one person there in case I lost my balance. I started off being able to take, three steps within the parallel bars in the PT gym with the wheelchair right behind me, holding on to the railing with one hand, because, well, the other one wouldn't, mm-hmm. while the therapist guided my affected leg. And then just being exhausted after three steps, to eventually, being able to leave the wheelchair at the hospital. And by the time I left the hospital, I was able to walk slowly with a cane, for several hundred feet, with an ankle brace on, because I was not able to lift my foot yet. The arm comes back a lot more slowly because it's a lot more smaller muscles, a lot more detail, and the shoulder is so complicated. But by the time I left, I was sort of, with a delay, able to sort of close my fingers into a fist. I didn't have any ability to open them up again, but I was starting to get a little bit of control back then. And really, recovery didn't stop then. It continued. After the hospital, I had in-home rehab for 6 weeks. Then I did outpatient for almost a year and continued to work on it. And, here we are 3.5 years out now, and I'm still working on getting function back. I can walk in my home without a cane now. Outside, I still need the ankle brace. I still need the cane. But in the home, I can get around without those things, which is so much more convenient. And I'm still gradually getting some hand use back. I can sort of hold light things in my hand now. And I'm just sort of over the last couple of months getting more ability to actually open my fingers voluntarily. So it's been a lot of that. It's an ongoing thing. One of the biggest myths around stroke recovery is that you have 6 months or you have 12 months and that's it. Then you plateau and you're done. And that is utter nonsense. I have a feeling I'm going to be recovering until I die. So that's another 150 years or so.
there you go.
But there are people decades out who are still getting some function back. But it takes time and it takes work. And if you tell your body that you're done recovering, your body is going to be done recovering.
That's fascinating. That was definitely a misconception that I had, that that you would reach kind of a plateau. And so that's really cool to hear that, 3.5 years later, there's still, it's not just maintaining, that there are actually functions that you are continuing to get back, which is really cool. Okay. So when you first did leave the hospital and head home, what were some of the most difficult things for you to do? Obviously moving and a lot of stuff, but what were the parts of daily life that either ended up being really, really difficult, or maybe even something that you didn't think about being difficult until you got home and had to do it?
There were so many little things that you figure out. Opening jars is, that takes two hands.
Yeah.
And I ended up getting an under-the-counter jar opener to accommodate that. I had to figure out that when I'm rummaging around the refrigerator for something, a lot of times you hold the door open. You couldn't do that. I ended up figuring out that I could open the vegetable drawer and that would prop the door open so I could find whatever it was I needed. Everything from simply buttering a waffle, because those things move around on the counter when you try to apply butter. going up and down stairs, I needed a handrail on both sides of the stairs. And often, you know, this one only on one side. So the handrail that I could use with my right hand to go up the stairs to my office, which was its own process for the first several weeks. Somebody had to be behind me while I did that, is not one that I can use to go downstairs.
Yeah.
So I had to have that installed. Stepping over anything, you know, a slight stoop, you know, a couple, 3 inches is surprisingly difficult when you have to get that affected limb over that. So that becomes really difficult. To shower, I had to have a special chair that actually hung out over the edge of the bathtub so I could sit down on that and then slide along that to get into the shower and shower seated. So it was all of those little things, plus the planning, where if I needed to get up and you know, to go to the bathroom or to go someplace else, I needed to allow time to try and put on my leg brace so that I could actually do that. But probably one of the biggest things was getting used to my energy level.
Yeah.
Because the fatigue is unlike anything I'd experienced before. I mean, I've been tired before. I'd gone 2-3 days without sleep before. And you can kind of push through. But after the stroke, the neurofatigue that hits, it's kind of like you suddenly hit that wall and you're absolutely done. There's nothing you can do. You just have to go to sleep. It's like when the cell phone, it doesn't go from like 60 to 50 to 40 to 30 to 20. It goes from 60 to 50 to 40 to 5 to 1 to nothing. And you're just done. I also had to replace the keyboard for my computer because I had been using an ergonomic keyboard beforehand. But when you're only typing with one hand,
yeah,
a split keyboard doesn't work for you anymore. So I had to switch back to a standard shaped keyboard. I've gotten up to about 30 words per minute one handed. But that was another one of those things. So it's a lot of those little things that you just don't think about. Reading a book becomes very difficult because if you're reading a paper book, you have to hold the book and you have to be able to turn pages.
Yeah.
And with one hand, that is very difficult to manage that. And you just don't think about these things until you have to. Turning over in bed is very difficult, or just scooching to the side is difficult because it's not just the arm and it's not just the leg. It's all of the muscles on the left side of the body. So that includes the core muscles, which are offline as well. Those ones that help you balance, that help you move, that help you move yourself around. All of that has to come back as well. So it's all of those things that just sort of add up to the experience. And you just got to do it. You just got to get through it to do the things that you ultimately want to do.
Yeah. So as you're talking about all these day-to-day things that suddenly presented an issue, and energy level ties into this, what were some of the, when you're spending so much time dealing with the day-to-day, the minutiae of this, or seeming minutiae, sometimes that does, I'm curious about big picture changes. Like, how did this affect maybe, you know, you talked about having stepping over things being very difficult. Does this mean that, you know, suddenly you had to take steps to be a tidier person and make sure things went away so they didn't get knocked off onto the floor? Or did this affect work in a way, or affect relationships? I'm curious about some of the big picture stuff that came out of having to make these smaller adjustments.
Well, there were definitely a lot of those impacts. I was both unfortunate and fortunate at the same time that when the stroke happened, I was out of work. I had been laid off from my job about 9 months earlier. And so I was actively job searching when this happened. And which also means that one of the best investment decisions I've made in my entire life was to pay for my Cobra insurance out of pocket a few months before the strokes, because otherwise this would have been really expensive for me. So what I had to do was I basically put my job search on hold for 3 months or so while I was like, okay, I need to just focus on this sort of recovery and getting better. I had to, for a couple of months, I couldn't drive because I had to go back and get a driving eval. And fortunately, they signed off on that. And then I had to get some modifications done to my car, which is relatively easy. All I needed in my case was to get a turn signal extension installed so I could operate my turn signal with my right hand and a spinner attached to the steering wheel so I could steer one-handed. But there was that part of it. And so that was a lot of that stuff. And it's like, okay, so let's start rethinking. What do we need to do with the job search? How can I stretch out the finances to go further? My girlfriend was living with me at the time, so she was able to take care of a whole lot of things, of sort of, you know, helping to keep things out of the way, doing most of the cooking and the cleaning, which really she had done most of that before the stroke anyway. I wasn't generally allowed in the kitchen before stroke or after. But especially since that time, I vaporized butter. But it turns out you're not supposed to crank a cast iron pan as hot as you can and then throw in a pat of butter. It's a bad idea. But so a lot of that, everything in our life was already in flux.
Okay.
She ended up going, she was in between jobs as well. So she ended up finding work before I did. And so there was a lot of just sort of adapting to that. And then I had to go ahead and let's rethink. Okay, so now this is my life now. Things are going to be a little bit different. How do I position that? Do I try to hide that? Do I try to just sort of embrace it and live it out? And in my case, since most of my disabilities are visible, I figured there's no point in me trying to hide this.
Yeah.
So I updated my LinkedIn profile with, you know, sort of what I was going through. And what can I learn from this? Now, my experience, my career was also as a corporate trainer, so focused on adult education and learning and development. And so I also started to see some of the parallels between what we do in that space versus what we do in physical therapy and occupational therapy, because ultimately it's a lot of the same core principles that come into play. And it's like, okay, how can I speak about these things in a way that makes sense, with being aware of what my limitations may be and how can I offer that. In my case, I was never a very athletic person, so losing the ability to, I mean, really after the stroke, if somebody wanted me to be on their corporate softball team, I'm really not much less effective than I would have been before the stroke. So that helped me a lot in that it wasn't like I was actively a musician or things like that. The disabilities I have aren't core to my personal identity. And I am very lucky with that. Had I had a stroke that resulted in aphasia or challenges with speech, I would have probably been in a much different situation.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that was, I was curious about that, about how that would affect a career. And fortunately for you, it wasn't something that was going to be inherently incompatible with what you did.
Exactly. Which also meant, of course, that pursuing disability wasn't an option.
Oh, yeah.
Because disability would require that you're not able to do your regular, your core career. And yeah. As a knowledge worker, that was not a thing. Exactly.
Yeah. Huh. I had not even thought about that. So they did all these tests. Did they figure out what caused this and how, whether you have high chances of having another one sometime down the road? What does the future look like here for that?
Well, the future is, I think it's looking okay for me. They found a couple of things. First of all, in that ultrasound of my heart, they did find that I have a PFO, which is a little hole between the right and left side of the heart that just didn't close up after birth. That's how our heart works when we're in utero and not breathing air. Most people, you know, like I said, up to about a third of the population has that hole. If it's big enough, clot can get through that and then go straight to the brain. In my case, they figured that's probably not what happened. What happened was a result of several years of high blood pressure. It goes back to several years before the stroke. There was over the Christmas holidays one year, I started having major nosebleeds every other day, like for like 30 minutes at a time. When I got to check my blood pressure, I was running like 200 over 160, which is practically emergency room territory.
Yeah.
So I got that treated, got to the doctor, got that treated, and my blood pressure had actually been under control for a good 6 to 12 months before my stroke. But in that time that it was excessive, it had done the damage. It had just left enough crap in those blood vessels in my brain that stuff built up, and then a clot formed there, which led to the stroke. My blood pressure since then has continued to stay in the healthier range. Their target should be 120 over 80 for most people. I've got my cholesterol down, blood sugar good. So those core metrics, being in much better shape now, mean that I am not at necessarily enhanced risk for having another one. There is, for the first 5 years after a stroke, you're definitely considered higher risk for another stroke. But with those numbers under control, I should be in better shape now. Although ultimately 25% of adults in the US will have a stroke in their lives. So this is definitely a thing, but the blood pressure, getting that under control is sort of the key to reducing that risk.
Okay. Yeah. I'm curious. This is just a question that I've been sometimes asking people, and sometimes it doesn't have any connection, but I'm curious as to how all this has been affected, or if it's been affected by the pandemic. How does the weird situation that the world finds itself in now change your life in this particular area?
It's changed in a few ways. I was planning to go back into PT earlier this year, to basically because I can't run yet. I wanted to figure out, let's go ahead and see if I can reacquire that skill, not because I'm ever going to be a runner, but because I want the ability to extract myself from a bad situation, should I find myself in one. I have certainly put that off. A lot of the PT facilities closed down, and a lot of that has opened up now, but I'm approaching it as the risk reward for that is not necessarily in my favor at this point to justify going back there. So I'll wait until that has cleared up a bit further. So that's been the major impact. The other thing is, I was already working from home 3 to 4 days a week. So I was able to continue doing that in my current job, which has been nice. It's been a change to my work environment, because I've had to pivot from doing live training sessions to doing more of that online.
Yeah.
And so that has certainly been a bit of it. It's also really brought, where I have the pandemic, I've really been seeing a lot more results in the way it impacts other people in my social circle now. Folks with other disabilities and with living with these other conditions, which can be more severe. And for many stroke survivors, there can be greater risk from contracting COVID. For example, if someone already has difficulty with swallowing, that means they probably don't have the strength to cough clearly and to clear their lungs. And if you can't cough or clear your lungs, that means that if you do contract the disease, you are much more likely to have severe complications from it. The other thing, of course, is that one of the longer-term impacts from COVID is we're seeing an increased risk of stroke from people who have survived COVID because of the damage it does to the heart and to the blood vessels. And I am now in a position where I have less brain tissue that I could sacrifice to another stroke. So I have to be more aware of that and those risks. And then, of course, it's just been sort of the other day-to-day stuff. It's, of course, changed the nature of what happens when I go in for my follow-up appointments and things like that. But since I was already mostly working remotely, the impact has been less direct on a lot of aspects of my life. Although I will say the big benefit of it is that it has made a lot of the world more accessible in some respects. The growth of curbside pickup for somebody who has challenges walking and dealing with grocery stores has been phenomenal. When I go to Costco or go to some of the other stores, if I do shop directly in the store, I still have to use the electric mobility card. It's not so much because it's a problem walking, but with only one hand, and it becomes very difficult to steer a shopping cart and manage a shopping cart while also using that for balance. But the advent of curbside pickup has made so much of that so much better. So I can just order online, drive up there, and they just load the car for me. And that is fantastic.
Yeah, I'm with you. I hope that some of the accessibility stuff that we're doing to accommodate everybody right now, I hope some of that sticks around in a stronger form than it was before this.
Absolutely. I think one of the things that that we're finding is that things like when you talk about accessible design, you're really just talking about good design. We've seen the change over the last 20 years of doorknobs going away to be replaced by door handles. That's an accessibility thing for people who have mobility challenges with their hands or their arms. And even before stroke, it made it so much easier to open a door when I had my hands full.
Absolutely. All right. So as we kind of wind this down, I want to ask first before I ask kind of my closing question, is there anything that you wanted to make sure and share about this experience that we didn't get to?
I would like to remind folks about my favorite word. And my favorite word is the word yet. Because so much of what we're doing and so much of stroke recovery, it comes down to the mindset. And it's not just about having a positive mental attitude, because a positive mental attitude is great, but it really takes an action-oriented mindset. And the right mindset is critical to recovery. Talk about the right attitude, the right mindset. It is a necessary condition to recover. It's not sufficient, it's not enough, but if you don't have the right attitude, you're not gonna recover. And that's why the word yet is so important to me, because I can talk about how I can't use my left hand, or I can talk about how I can't use my left hand yet. It's about sort of recognizing the reality of today, but making a plan for it to be different tomorrow. So what I would say is to anybody, one of the key things I've learned here is that to anybody who thinks that they can't do something that they want to do, always add the word yet to the end of that. Instead of I can't do this, I can't do this yet, because that sort of paints a path forward for you.
I like that. All right. Well, and that actually might tie into my final question, which is this podcast is going to go out to essentially two groups of people, one who has gone through this and one who has not. And so I would love to hear, what would you say maybe to somebody who has, maybe is in the process of recovering from a stroke and is maybe frustrated or not sure or scared and doesn't know where to go with this, maybe some encouragement for them. And then on the flip side, what would you say to somebody who has not gone through this? Granted, you said a huge amount, a very large percentage of people will have one at some point in their lifetime. So maybe what do you think people who have not had this need to know about this before it happens maybe to them or to someone that they love?
Okay, first thing, let's start with the second group, and really everybody to begin with. Most important thing to remember out of all this is be fast. B-E-F-A-S-T. because that's the key to recognizing when a stroke happened. We talked a little while ago about how important it is to get prompt treatment. So you want to remember, always be fast. B is for balance. A sudden loss or change in balance can indicate a stroke. E is for eyes. Sudden loss or change in vision or partial change in vision can indicate a stroke. I've had folks tell me that they've had, for example, suddenly their vision is rotated 90 degrees, or suddenly you lose half, you lose the right side of your vision in both eyes. F is for face. Sudden facial drooping on one side can indicate a stroke. A is for arms. Inability to hold both arms out in front of you can indicate a stroke is happening. S is for speech. Sudden loss of speech, slurring of speech, loss of language, difficulty speaking can indicate a stroke. And T is for time to call an ambulance. You need to call an ambulance rather than, well, obviously you can't drive, you shouldn't drive yourself or have somebody else drive you to the ER, because the ambulance can begin triage before you get there. They can have the ER prepped. And most importantly, they know which hospital to take you to. So be fast. Balance, eyes, face, arm, speech, time to call an ambulance. Be fast. Now, for folks who have experienced this already and who are struggling, most important thing is to, there's two things. First of all, focus on your goals, focus on what you want to accomplish rather than your limitations. One of the things they taught us, what I learned, spent a day learning to ride a motorcycle when I was living in Montana in the 90s, and it's the last time I ever got on a motorcycle. But one of the things they taught us was that if you're driving along and you see an obstacle in the middle of the road, don't look at it. Instead, look at the path around the obstacle, because your brain will take you to whatever you focus on. Focus on the path around your obstacles. And the same thing happens with stroke recovery. But the big thing is find your community. Find people that you can connect with, because the stroke club is filled with cool kids, but the dudes really suck. And it is an amazing group of people that you can find either through a local support group that during COVID times is probably meeting online, or and you can certainly contact your doctors, your hospitals, whatever, for information about that. Or go out on social media, go out on Instagram and search stroke or search stroke survivors. The Instagram community especially is amazing when it comes to strokes, and the community of people that are out there is just fantastic for support. There's dozens of Facebook stroke support groups out there. So you can search for those there. On Twitter, you can search the hashtag stroke and you'll find a lot more medical information there and medical professionals talking about research and stuff like that. But there's survivors posting there as well. But the community of stroke survivors is so important, because once you connect with this community, once you connect with this group of people, you're connecting with a group of people who get it. I mean, when I've run meetings where I welcome new survivors to the meeting and say, look, if it takes you longer to say your words, that's fine. If it takes you longer to walk across the room, or you need assistance with pouring a cup of coffee, that's fine. You're around a group of people who get it. You can just relax with that. And that's something they probably don't get in their regular, among their other friends and family. And that's okay. But connect with the survivor community, because it is welcoming and it is a fantastic group of people.
That's awesome. I love that. All right. So first of all, thank you so much for agreeing to come on and share this with us. I think this is a really important and encouraging and interesting conversation. So thank you so much for sharing.
No, you're very welcome. I'm very appreciative of the opportunity. I always love talking about this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's as well go ahead and give our listeners an idea of where else they can find your work or other things you might want to plug for them, your own project or some other resources, whatever you'd like.
Sure. So I'd always been a podcast fan, and for a decade or so before my stroke. And when I had my stroke, there weren't very many shows out there. So I started the podcast that I wish existed when I had my stroke. and that is the Stroke Cast. So after you're done listening to this episode and all of Hannah's back catalog, be sure to go ahead and subscribe to Stroke Cast in your favorite podcast app, or just visit strokecast.com for more information there. You can also find me on Instagram, where I am Bills_StrokeCast. Be happy to connect with you there. And you can always find more information about me and the rest of my links over at BillMonroe.net, BillMonroe.net. Go ahead and subscribe to StrokeCast.com to hear more from the stroke survivor community, medical professionals involved in research, and industry partners who are supporting stroke recovery and rehab.
Awesome. Yeah, absolutely. And I'll make sure I put all of that in the episode description so that if folks didn't jot any of that down, that they can still find you. Thank you again so much for sharing this. It's been a great conversation. And I look forward to sharing this with the world. And listeners, thank you all so much for tuning in. And you can come back next week to hear me talk to somebody else about something completely different. And as always, if you want to be a guest on a future podcast, you can email me at whatsitlikethepodcast@gmail.com. Or you can follow me on Twitter at @podwhatsitlike. And you can fill out a guest form. And I'd love to bring you on. Everybody's got a story or an experience to share. And I'd love to hear yours. Either way, we will see you next week.